My guest today is Mr. Jeff Blankford, the man who sued the Anti-Defamation League and won. He was a speaker at the recent summit on reassessing Israel's special relationship. It was a huge summit, over 8 hours of speakers, 13 minutes each. The link to that full video is below. Mr. Blankford, welcome back. Now, my friend Michael Kyle, who's also been on this program, flew in from Japan. I saw that he had taken pictures with you, so I assume you met there on the floor. Did you see Michael Kyle while you were there?
Oh, yeah. We were staying in the same hotel, same floor. It was a huge, oversized Marriott hotel, but it was very convenient because it was only a few steps to the National Press Club where we had the summit. So we bent an elbow and had some lunch together, then breakfast together. It was great because actually the summit, I met a number of people who I've corresponded with and interviewed over the years, like Ray McGovern and so on, Stephen Snagowski, and I finally met Gareth Porter. So I got a chance to meet these folks, you know, in person.
It seems like that was the case for everybody. They've all talked to each other like I am now over the mic and or radio or Skype or something, but very few of them had met in person.
Yeah, and it was great. It was a tremendous event, and it was really terrific that C-SPAN 3 broadcast it all day, so the links were up there because, predictably, the so-called left media, the damage control operators, ignored it.
Well, this was the summit on Israel's special relationship, or reassessing Israel's special relationship. 8 hours worth of material. Grant Smith has it up on ermep.org right now, and I have it up on my site as well.
Right.
For everybody.
Yeah, it's very important that people see this because it came actually at a very appropriate time where AIPAC has been more open than usual about pushing the U.S. into a war with Iran. And even though it appears to a lot of Johnny-come-latelys that AIPAC has been defeated, at least for the moment, it is a fact that AIPAC has written all the sanctions legislation up to this point against Iran, as they do against Syria, against Libya, and so on before that. So these sanctions are not worldwide sanctions. These are sanctions not only against Iran, but against any country or company that breaks these sanctions. And of course, they can get waivers, but nevertheless, these organizations, pro-Israel organizations in the United States, one particularly called United Against Nuclear Iran, acts as a huge lobbying organization for Israel out of New York, writing to companies around the world demanding that they stop any kind of interaction, business interaction with Iran, as if they have some kind of credibility. And they get responses, actually, because these countries know who is behind this organization.
Right, and they say, well, we'll lose more if we don't comply.
That's right, and we realize how American, quote, Israel, American-oriented these sanctions are. And as soon as the negotiations began with Iran, businessmen from all over Europe, including the United States, went to Iran to see what kind of deals they could make. Because if it was not for the Israel lobby, Iran would be selling oil on the international market to America, to Exxon, ExxonMobil, to BP. These companies have no problem dealing with Iran, or they wouldn't have had with Iraq, but because the power of the Israel lobby is so great in the United States, and that oil companies have a very low standing, so oil companies can't go head-to-head with AIPAC. They know that. They tried it once. Mobil used to run ads on the op-ed page of the New York Times. They gave up doing that because they know who the power is.
I'm glad you said that because yesterday was the 11th anniversary of the war in Iraq, the second war, the second invasion of Iraq.
That's
and
right.
There's still a lot of leftists out there that say that this is a war for oil or a war for the petrodollar or blah, blah, blah. And not even looking at the neocons that actually wrote the lies that led to war, and how it wasn't about oil, how a lot of oil companies actually opposed it, how they already had the oil under the Oil for Food program anyway, and that it was for Israeli interests that the U.S. went to war, and each pre-invasion lie, as you've written before, came not from big oil, but from these neocons, who were Israeli partisans, which is very, very clear.
Well, the evidence is that the main recipient of Iraq oil was China, under a $3 billion contract that had been negotiated before the war with Saddam, and then Russia and Malaysia in there, and what the American oil companies got were service contracts, but not the big deal. Now, in the Kurdish area, which is still up in the air, Exxon made some deals with Kurdistan, but whether any oil is flowing out of there now, for now, it's very difficult to say, but the idea that this war would be for oil should be proved by the evidence that after the war, the oil came to the U.S. oil majors, and it hasn't. But
well, also, even this if is, they expected it to and it didn't, you can see before the war that all these lies about weapons of mass destruction and anthrax and liberating Kurds and so on, they came from the Office of Special Plans and Douglas Feith. They didn't come from ExxonMobil.
They had to set up a special office in the Pentagon in order to fabricate the evidence, and they've not been able to connect any of these people to oil companies. So, but it's a lot easier because the alternative is blaming Israel, and this goes, you could tie this together with the whole theory propounded by Chomsky and his acolytes that Israel is supported by the United States because it's an asset. And this is a way to take blame away from those who should be blamed, from the shoulders, which is the Zionist Jews in Palestine in 1948, and those around the world have supported them ever since. I mean, we've heard so many times from people who know nothing that the British put the Jews in Palestine in 1917. They wanted them there to control the Suez, to guard the Suez. This is ridiculous on its face. Not only did the British already have troops in Egypt, a lot closer to the Suez, and in Transjordan, and in Iraq, and in Iran, Persia and Iran, there was absolutely no need to have a problem with the Arabs in Palestine, who they had promised independence to before the war. And so you look at the Foreign Office papers that were published, the British Foreign Office papers, showed that the Jews in Palestine were nothing but a major headache to the British throughout the time of the mandate. And the British got nothing from this, absolutely nothing. And yet the alternative is, if the British imperialism responsible, then who is? And then you take 1948. No imperial power supported the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians by the Zionist Jews, supported by the Jewish lobbies around the world, not Jewish lobbies, the Jewish communities around the world. And yet, when you bring this up, you usually get dead silence or end of conversations, because there's no other country that can be blamed for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, except the Zionist Jews in Palestine at the time and their supporters. And again in 1967, the second most important act in the Israel-Palestine relations was 1967. Even though there were some Americans who supported it, the arms were all French. De Gaulle broke all his contracts with Israel because he told them not to attack Egypt. Israel was not threatened by Egypt. This was a myth. And so, again, the two most significant acts in the Israel-Palestine...
Between those two in 54 and 56, the British, French, and Israelis attacked Egypt together. And they used pretext for that, too, with the infamous Levant affair.
It's interesting that records show that had Israel attacked Egypt on its own, the United States under Eisenhower might have physically, militarily intervened U.S. troops against Israeli troops. But because Britain and France were both in on it and were allies, Eisenhower only told Israel to get out of there. Otherwise, they would lose immediately. They would lose their tax exempt status, which was a major thing for Israel, getting money from Jews in the United States, which they still do, which are tax exempt. But this is the only time that has been threatened, and yet you see, and Israel back down.
57, and Eisenhower said for 10 years they're going to monitor this place, and 1967 would have been 10 years later, less than a month after the troops were removed, Israel attacks again.
That would have been Well, Egypt had asked for the troops to be removed, but the reality, there was no Egyptian buildup sufficient to launch a war on Israel. And after the war was over, an Israeli general, Mahdi Peled, who was in charge of logistics in the Six-Day War, and became a peacenik. He became a supporter of Palestinian statehood, two-state solution, which was, for an Israeli general, was pretty radical. He debated a leading Israeli over whether the war against Egypt was a war of necessity or war of choice. And he was able to easily prove it was a war of choice. What was really interesting at that time, and is not discussed anywhere as far as I know it, but in the newspapers before 67, I remember reading in the U.S. newspaper that before Israel attacked Egypt, more Jews were leaving Israel than arriving. Their economy was stagnant, was dead in the water, and American Jews at that point, which had supported Israel in the beginning, really didn't care so much. They weren't going to Israel. They weren't making Aliyah. They weren't emigrating there. And the same thing was true of Jews of other countries. And they had no basis, really, to appeal to world Jewry to come to their support. So they did what many countries have done when they're in trouble and they need to get people rallying around them. They launched a war on Egypt. And that war on Egypt turned the Jewish communities around the world, which had not been particularly Zionist at all, into strong supporters of Israel. The triumphalism, I remember in Los Angeles, where I was at the time, was obscene. And I, frankly, was involved with the Vietnam War. I was working with the Black Panthers. I didn't pay any attention to the Middle East. But in Los Angeles, you could not avoid seeing the triumphalism, as if the people in Beverly Hills or North Hollywood, Studio City, Hollywood, had actually been on the front lines fighting the Egyptians. And that triumphalism has never diminished to the point where it has not been very effective in keeping support for Israel high in the agenda, uppermost on the agenda of the Jewish establishment.
What the majority of Jews, kind of political ties, it's more ethnic ties. It would be if I don't know,
tribalism,
went to war or something. You could see a lot of Irish Americans siding with it just because they're Irish, and doesn't matter what the reason is.
It's tribalism. That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's tribalism, and the difference is the Irish don't tell the rest of the world what to do. Whereas you have Israel has this, they want to eat their cake and have it too, or the Jewish establishment. I call it the Zion turn, the Zionist International. They have this tribalism, which is manifest in all their newspapers and publications, without question. There's no humanism in the sense. The concern is always, is something good for the Jews or not? And it's a joke in the Jewish community, is it good for the Jews? But I don't think other communities, like, is it good for the Irish? Is it good for African Americans? Is it good for the Indians and so on? You don't hear that. So what it is not only do they have this kind of ghetto mentality, in one sense, this tribal mentality, but at the same time, they want to tell other communities what to do and what not to do. And it's going to backfire. You know, recently, with this gesture called the Quenelle by Dieudonné Mambala Mambala in France, which has been called by the Jewish establishment there, which is very powerful in France, the reverse of a Nazi salute, This is in their minds, you see. And so you have an African soccer player in England, and he has been banned from playing by the British Football Association. He has been banned from playing soccer for any British football team. Now, you probably have to look at the owners of the teams who runs the British Football Association, and you'll see that's probably occupied territory, just as the sports world is occupied territory in the United States.
Now, the canal is anti-establishment. It's a sign.
It's anti-establishment.
Bucking the man.
Right. Yeah, it's an expression like in Italy, if you want to say up yours, you raise your right, you crook your right arm in an L shape and grab your right bicep with your left hand, and you thrust it into the air. The expression is up yours. And that's what the canal is. And they've tried to make it into something else. And the reality is backfiring on them.
Yeah, you could just people do the actual Nazi salute if that's what you meant. And there are plenty of those going on in Ukraine right now, and the U.S. and Israelis don't seem to have a problem backing them.
Well, it's interesting, you know, getting into the Ukraine, that is probably the fastest blowback I've seen, at least in terms of U.S. policy is concerned, because the U.S. has been planning and working to undermine Ukrainian government and bring it into the European Union and particularly NATO for years. And Victoria Nuland, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Asia, who just happens to be the wife of Robert Kagan, the founder, one of the two founders of the Project for New American Century,
and Weekly Standard,
and the Emergency Committee for Israel, mm-hmm. and who is a fallen foreign policy advisor for John McCain, and who is now on the Foreign Policy Advisory Committee for Hillary Clinton. She was bragging to a Ukrainian-American group in December how the United States has spent $5 billion, $5 billion since 1991, in trying to, quote, bring democracy to the Ukraine. Now, we saw pictures of Victoria Nuland and Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt marching with protesters in the Ukraine. We saw pictures of John McCain. He goes everywhere. Yeah. And one can imagine what would be like if when the U.S. was having a protest, maybe the March on Washington in 1963 with Dr. King, if the Russian politicians were marching in that march and talking with Dr. King, if during the Vietnam War, you had Russian officials, Russian politicians coming over and embracing and giving candy to the protesters who were being gassed in Chicago. It wouldn't even happen because the United States, no other country would consider doing what the United States does. French politicians weren't marching in Kiev, but here's Victoria Nuland, here's Jeffrey Pyatt marching with the protesters. They should have been put on a plane and sent out of the country. I mean, Yanukovych was no favorite of Putin's, but Putin's a chess player, and you don't have to like Putin, but you have to realize, which Americans simply don't realize because they're historically challenged, is that Crimea is historically a part of Russia longer than the United States has been a country. And the people there, obviously, that election, even though it was hurriedly called, the people there obviously supported it. I mean, there was no... there were all these celebrations in the streets. They couldn't hide that. And yet, they claim that the coup...
towards ethnic Russians in Ukraine since the collapse of the Soviet Union, at least, for a long time. It's not something that only started with the Stefan Bandera crowd. That's been going on. So when they had a chance to leave, compounding that with the financial crisis of being 15 billion euros in the hole to predatory lenders from these banking institutions, of course, they ran to Russia as fast as they could.
Well, who ran to Russia? The Crimeans, you mean?
I mean, Crimea was part of Russia anyway, but it was a semi-autonomous region. It had its own parliament. But they were considered part of Ukraine ever since Khrushchev gave it away, which was in reaction to how horrible Russia had treated Ukraine prior to and during World War II. but it had always had that.
Right.
It was still part of the Soviet Union anyway, so it was sort of a gesture on paper.
It was a gesture on paper that had no real meaning, and it didn't change the lives of anyone. But it's true that the Ukrainians were treated badly by the Russians under Stalin in the 30s with the famine and post-famine when they opposed the forced collectivization. On the other hand, you had this fascist crowd that joined and fought with the Nazis and still were anti-Russian. And so one of the first things they did was ban Russia as an official language right after the coup. Now, this was a coup. Here you had an elected government. Whatever Yanukovych was, how corrupt he is, I think corruption is probably the norm in governments around the world. And there was an election going to come up, but they didn't want to wait for that. So it's interesting how the United States, who talks about democracy, elected governments, is very quick to go and support governments that overthrow democratic elected governments. You see what's happening in Venezuela right now. The opposition to Maduro there, they can't win an election. And so they're out in the streets. But I'm not a particular fan of Maduro, but I think he follows Chavez's footsteps in representing the poor and dispossessed of the country who support him. And so these people can't win a fair election. And so what they're doing is trying to take an elected official out and make the government ungovernable or push them to the point where the government becomes repressive. This happened in Syria. It's a different situation. But here, again, there's this move. And you can see, I'm sure there's neocon involvement in Venezuela. I haven't investigated that much. I'm doing an interview next week with a Venezuelan professor, Miguel Tenker-Salas, who's a professor in Claremont, California, who's in Venezuela, is coming back next Tuesday. And I hope to get the kind of the lowdown what's going on there. But
that'll be interesting. I like to mirror that talk. Another example is Paraguay. When they had the coup a few Julys ago, the first country to recognize the new leadership was the United States. And that was just another national endowment of democracy overthrow. They had a quick 24-hour sort of trial and impeachment, and it was definitely a coup d'etat. And Egypt's another example. And so, and there's
Honduras.
There's so many examples where democracy
Haiti.
Doesn't matter.
Dominican Republic back in 65. Mm-hmm. Grenada.
Chile.
The list is endless, and yet the American people are historically challenged. And the schools don't educate them. And what passes for the left doesn't pay attention to what's going on either. I mean, we don't have a left in this country. We don't have an anti-imperialist movement. And we're more spectators than we should be. We have to be participants. And now people are getting into the next election. This is another election year. And the question is, will the Koch brothers buy the Senate? And that's what people are talking about. And then we have
Koch
the presidential. Well, they could buy Soros. They're actually Soros will support the Democrats, but not to the extent the Koch brothers are supporting the Republicans. But what's happening though is there's no participation from any radical forces. I'm not going to use the term revolutionary because that's just a dream. The U.S. would be closer to a fascist takeover than a radical takeover from the left, for sure. But
well, just following the Constitution would be revolutionary.
Oh yeah, right. Following the Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, the Second Amendment has been perverted. But we have the prospect of Hillary Clinton becoming the next president, at least a candidate for Democratic Party. And here's Hillary Clinton, who, as I mentioned earlier, had Victoria Nuland as her press spokesperson when she was Secretary of State, and now has brought her husband aboard as a foreign policy advisor who just left John McCain's campaign to be on Hillary Clinton's campaign. And last December, at the Saban Forum in Washington, started by Haim Saban, an Israeli-American who has one issue, which he admits to, that's Israel. He bought the Brookings Institution for $12.3 million. He had gained his billions, beginning of his billions, by putting out, getting a hold of the rights to distribute this Japanese kids program called the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And Hillary, speaking at the Saban Forum, proudly admitted she was one of Haim's Power Rangers. Now, I play this on my radio. I played the audio on my radio program. But that's the only, it's on YouTube. But you see, this is something that the so-called left alternative media ignore.
And if your kids don't are into that and you want to avoid Power Rangers, go with Kyoruja or Kamen Rider instead. It's the same thing, but better. It doesn't have anything to do with him. This little plug.
I'm sorry?
It's just for people with kids who watch that kind of stuff if they don't want to be...
Oh, right, right.
Yeah. Kamen Rider.
Well, I remember the first time I became aware of Haim Saban was I was lying in bed on a Saturday morning, and I flipped on the television to see what was on, and I saw a kid's program, a cartoon, and what struck me as odd was a blonde girl was kind of the heroine with these Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and I wonder, and she turned out to be an Israeli girl. Well, what is this? So I waited till the end of the program to see who put this thing out, and I saw the name Haim Saban. So from that time on, I started following his career, and I would go and speak at various places in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I would ask, how many people here have heard Haim Saban? And if anybody raised their hand, usually maybe one person, I'd say, where did you hear about him? And the person would say, I heard you talking about him. But you'll never hear him mentioned on Democracy Now. You won't see him written up in The Nation. And this is one of the biggest donors of the Democratic Party, and more Israeli-oriented than, let's say, George Soros is not Israeli-oriented. He tries to put money where he can become like a benevolent capitalist, if such a thing exists. Whereas, I mean, Soros is despised in Israel as well because he doesn't, at least publicly, support Israeli projects, but Saban does. And in 2002, he also gave, same year he bought the Brookings Institution, he gave $12.3 million to the Democratic Party, $7 million of which was to build the Democratic Party's headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Well, also, he's given a plutocracy ruled by money, where they just can purchase congressmen, purchase presidents, and we really need an organizational force to combat that. But like you said, there's no radical or whatever you want to call it. We don't really have organization. There's have been times where there were sort of themes with Occupy or the Tea Party, and both those camps got hijacked and diverted into idiocy, if I may say. But we don't really have a force. A little bit in the libertarian movement economically opposing the Fed and things, but when it comes to foreign policy, the entire anti-war wing is splintered into a million pieces and there's no real organization.
Well, I've maintained that it's occupied. It's an occupied territory. It has been for years. This is why when I was speaking in Washington, I had kind of a subject that created controversy. I was asked to speak about gatekeepers of the left. And did they exist? And I did. I said, yes, they did. And I quoted Lenny Brenner, who is a historian who did the foremost work on research on the Israeli or Zionist Nazi connection. And in an interview with me some years ago, maybe 15 years ago, he said the left is a rear guard of the Israel lobby. And this is what it is. They have done very cleverly everything they possibly could do, whatever the motivation is to protect the lobby and also for years to separate the Israel-Palestinian issue or the Palestinian struggle from all the other struggles going on around the world, like against apartheid in South Africa, against the U.S. and Central America. Not only did they do that, but they also maintained silence on Israel's role in South Africa and on Israel's role in Central America. They controlled those, what they call the solidarity groups from Nicaragua.
Yeah, Contra.
Around Contra was a great opportunity to talk about Israel. Daniel Inouye, the U.S. senator who was kind of behind the scenes running the show, referred to Israel as Country A. Inouye was a Japanese-American who fought in World War II while his relatives were in a concentration camp in California. And he came back and became a senator from Hawaii. But before he did that, his first job was as salesman for State of Israel bonds. And it's obviously that the Israelis at the AIPAC put him up, as they have a number of other politicians, to run for political office. And Inouye became one of Israel's strongest supporters in the Senate. And when he died, they had big, dinners in his honor, tributes in his honor from Israel. But no U.S. senator did more for Israel than did Inouye.
He made sure it was closed hearings on all the portions that dealt with Israel during Rand's
trials. That's right. And one of the problems...
I believe that's confidential, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah. I call him the one-armed bandit. He lost an arm in World War II, but he was robbing the U.S. Treasury on Israel's behalf. He once got embarrassed because he had appropriated $8 million for a Jewish school, and it turned out it was in Paris. But
at least it existed.
He was going to convert to Judaism, but was convinced not to do so because they said, "You're much more effective for us staying a Methodist." When Jonathan Pollard got busted, he was just about to introduce a bill that would forgive all of Israel's back debts. So this man, his major work in the U.S. Senate was not for Hawaii and not for the United States, but it was for the State of Israel. And when George Bush Sr. announced that he was going to have a national press conference and oppose Israel's $10 billion in loan guarantees, that he was going to veto it, Moshe Aarons, who was the foreign minister of Israel, who was in the United States at the time, was in the office. And in his office was Daniel Inouye. Why the U.S. senator would be in the meeting with the Israeli foreign minister is another question. But when Aarons told Inouye what was going to happen, what Bush was going to do, according to Aarons in his book, Broken Covenant, he said, Inouye was furious. He said, "This means war. Where's my yarmulke?" Which is a little cap that religious Jews wear. And so... but these are stories.
It's not supposed to be for war.
Yeah, I mean, it would be humorous if it wasn't so serious, because all one has to do is look at Iraq, a destroyed country, and destroyed. Last time we spoke, you brought up the Oded Yanan plan, mm-hmm. The plan of an Israeli strategic military analyst back in the 80s who wrote a book. Or publication, a pamphlet called Strategy for Israel in the 80s. And its goal was to break up Israel's Arab neighbors into their religious confessional sects. And if you look at Iraq, you look at Syria, they are succeeding mightily. Iraq is a destroyed country. No one profits more from the Shia-Sunni conflict than Israel. And we could count on bombings continuing. I'm not saying that Israel is conducting those bombings. But I'm not saying they're not.
Well, they did bomb sometimes, Syria this week. And Gaza.
Well, interesting. They have attacked Syria a number of times since the Syrian civil war began without any retaliation. So suddenly, four Israeli soldiers are wounded by a roadside bomb near the Golan border. And now Israel says, "We've got to retaliate." And so they attack Syria. this is a country that's literally
very Israel. It always starts when they got hurt, and erases all the times where they've been bombing and killing people.
Yeah, they have no. They attack Gaza. They're always attacking Gaza. They're always conducting assassinations in Gaza, and they make small headlines. And then suddenly, when some firing of rockets comes back from Gaza, they pretend that their hands are clean, and then they go on with their U.S. paid for F-15s or Apache helicopters.
Rockets that hit nothing and do nothing.
They hit nothing. Yeah, I mean,
before shooting them themselves.
It wouldn't surprise me, actually. I mean, the logic says that Israel is running some Palestinian groups. Israel wouldn't be the first country to do this. Well, the rockets are not particularly accurate. I mean, they're pretty much homemade. But the point is that they can get someone to do this through a cutout who doesn't even know that he's doing it for Israel. It's the same thing in Iraq. Let's say there's a lull in the bombings and the killings in Iraq. Well, they need to heat up the situation. So what do? Through a cutout, they would get somebody in Iraq, Shia or Sunni, to launch an attack, do a suicide bombing that would kill a number of people and keep this war between the Sunnis and Shia going.
Or they just send snipers in to shoot up a funeral or a wedding, as happened in Syria and possibly Ukraine.
Yeah, and there's no way they're going to get caught because they have cutouts and maybe more than one cutout. So if somebody's caught...
The story of the British wearing wigs and robes and everything and going and attacking, I think they were killing Sunnis. It may have been the other way around, Shiites or something, but
they were arrested in front of Iraq.
Arab Muslims and put in jail. The British had to get a tank and knock down the wall to get them out.
And the story, that story has been phased out of the history because it doesn't fit in with the accepted narrative.
I mean, that should have been the CIA just caught with 4 tons of cocaine on an airplane crash moment, you know, where, okay, you've been busted in this false flag. Nothing happened.
Nothing happens. You had Richard Davis in Pakistan. And obviously, this guy was there working undercover. I believe he had killed 2 Pakistanis. And so we don't hear anything more about Richard Davis. But the Pakistanis hate us, but we don't care. It's not a... As long as the American people believe what they're told or don't care to believe what they're told, if they don't pay any attention to it, that's fine. But whether it's Bush or Obama, the U.S. has seriously messed up the world and guided at least in Iraq and perhaps and no doubt in dealing with Iran by the hand of Israel exerted through the neocons or whoever they can get in the United States to do their bidding.
Let's talk about the summit you went to a little bit more. Did you have any favorite speakers? Is that fair to ask that kind of question? I don't know. But was there anything there that maybe you had not heard enough about and got to learn a lot about?
Well, I think it was very thorough. They had invited a number of speakers expecting that many would turn it down. But quite the opposite occurred. And a great number of the speakers who were invited said they would come. Since it was only going to be for a single day, speakers were generally limited to around 13 minutes. So you had to really make prepared remarks in order to get what you wanted to say in that space of time. And it was quite amazing how well it went. I mean, you had some really important speakers on important issues. There was a former FBI intelligence agent who spoke about Jonathan Pollard and why Jonathan Pollard was a serious espionage agent for Israel and that what he had done was very serious and not like his supporters in the Israeli community and some of the former CIA people who are now in bed with the Israeli lobby have tried to say that this guy was over prosecuted because of Caspar Weinberger's personal animus against Pollard. But the fact is this guy, I think his name, Lyman, I'm not sure exactly, I don't remember his name, but he gave a very concise talk. And he was actually not that much of a critic of the Israel-U.S. relationship, but he had written a piece in the New York Times, an op-ed piece, and that prompted the organizers to get him to speak. But he's serious about Jonathan Pollard staying in prison and being one of the worst.
Mike Bowman talked about Pollard's case at the summit as well.
I'm sorry?
Spike Bowman.
Oh, that's the guy. That's Spike Bowman. That's the one I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And actually, one interesting story that I was aware of but is not generally known, Alison Weir, If Americans Knew, which is one of the sponsoring groups, talked about the story of Dorothy Thompson. Dorothy Thompson was, back in the 40s, considered the second most important woman in the United States after Eleanor Roosevelt. Eleanor Roosevelt had an outsized reputation. No wife of any president has ever had a reputation like Eleanor Roosevelt had. And Dorothy Thompson was number two. She was a journalist who had been thrown out of Germany by the Nazis, and she was very sympathetic, particularly to the Jews who had perished there in the Jewish struggle. But after World War II, she went to Palestine, or to Israel, and was left in Palestine. And she saw the way the Israelis were treating the Palestinians and came back and spoke the truth. She had her own radio program. She had a column that appeared in national newspapers. Well, today she is not heard of at all. Nobody knows Dorothy Thompson because the women, people who control the women's movement, happen to be Jewish and Zionist. I mean, people say that you sound anti-Semitic. I said, well, if they weren't Jewish and Zionist, and I said they were Jewish and Zionist, that might be anti-Semitic, but they happen to be Jewish and Zionist, and that's why people don't know about Dorothy Thompson, one of the most important women in American history. And so,
pony issue is usually anti-racism, but when it comes to ethnically cleansing Palestinians or now in the Ukraine with the Nazis, they're very silent. They completely support racism, under those circumstances. If it's Jewish racism, it's okay, I guess, because that's got God involved or whatever, but it's so odd because they seem at odds with that on every other aspect. They would oppose that. If there was someone else, you know, like blacks getting ethnically cleansed in Africa by whites or something, the world would lose its mind. But if it's Arabs getting killed by Jews, well, that kind of racism's all right. It's so weird to me. Like, racism is racism, and murder is murder. But
well,
a lot of the third world doesn't count.
You're right. This is where tribalism is more important than the religion, because many Jewish activists around Israel, or most of them, are secular. They're not Orthodox. They're not ultra-Orthodox. They're secular. And they choose about what to believe. So they would like to believe that God gave Israel to the Jews, but they don't believe the other strictures of God. They don't believe in God, but at the same time, they'll say God gave Israel.
Well, they believe in the religious history instead of actual history, which might not incorporate any of the supernatural stuff, but it is still given into believing something that isn't true.
I mean, well, God, if you go and
that is ridiculous. I mean, actually, the entire concept of the world being divided in Jews and Gentiles, basically Jews and non-Jews, comes from the faith. And if you're really truly secular, you'd reject that too and say, well, that's a religious concept. We're not actually different. You know, we're just Semitic people too. The whole like ethnic origin centers around Judaism, which is a mythical, you know, religious type of history with the Abraham, who, in my opinion, is a fictional character, and Adam and Eve, who are also fictional characters. And so you can't really have this bloodline to Jacob if Jacob didn't exist. But they still do. And so I don't know if I'd call them secular or not. I just call them selectively religious. They just take up the passages they want and ignore the rest. Hypocrites, basically.
Hypocrite, basically. Interesting, there was one speaker there, Alan Braunfeld, from the American Council of Judaism, who is like a dinosaur in the Jewish community. The American Council of Judaism was a religious organization and was very important back in the late 30s and 40s as an anti-Zionist organization, opposing Israel becoming a Jewish state. And at one time they had clout, and they insisted Judaism was a religion and not, it wasn't a Jewish people, it was a religion. And they opposed, as you see, they did whatever they possibly could to prevent a Jewish state coming into being. But Alan Braunfeld made a mistake when he was talking, in which he said that when Moses received the tablets, the Ten Commandments of the Sinai, he said those were intended for everybody, but they weren't. If you read the Old Testament, they were intended rules for Jews. And so thou shalt not kill applied to other Jews, not to other people, because you find the God that the Hebrews created ordering them to carry out several genocides and usually kill everything. And on one occasion, I guess who it was, but if the women are comely, you could take the women. But otherwise, you kill them all, children, whatever.
The following chapter after the Ten Commandments, which is Exodus 20, Exodus 21, talking about beating slaves and how to conquer people, etc. So,
and Moses himself killed an Egyptian.
Also, slavery's in two of the Ten Commandments as well. You have the tenth saying not to covet your neighbor's wife, ox, or slave. And then I think it's the sixth that says to keep the Sabbath holy, and that even slaves have to keep it holy too. So they're acknowledging slavery, and they're benevolent God never has a commandment that says thou shalt not own people, but they continue that on, and it's very clear that it's meant for his people, not all people, because you see the whole book of Kings and all the rest of it of that's exactly what happened, Jews dominating militarily over their neighbors.
Well, what's interesting is with all the propaganda, which is what it became over the years of how Jews suffered as slaves, and they say to blacks in America, well, we have suffered too, as if some Jew living in 2000, the 20th century, 21st century, has suffered at all, whereas blacks in America, in their families were in slavery, their grandparents, and their parents suffered under Jim Crow. But I ask people, I say, look, if slavery was so bad, why isn't it a commandment? Is it worse? Is sleeping with your neighbor's wife worse than slavery? Coveting your neighbor worse than slavery? But the reason is Jews kept slaves.
Coveting your neighbor's stuff is how capitalism works. No.
Buy your neighbor is the way it works, right? But you see all these contradictions, but no one challenges them, because to do so is to be called anti-Semitic. And this is how, even
well, to
though
be fair, it's in the other religious faiths too. I mean, they have slavery also, but you get apologists, and you even have some rationalizing. Go, well, they mean indentured servants. Like, no, because they have those too. They mean both, and indentured servants is also wrong. So I mean, doesn't really matter. But yeah, I mean, it from an atheist perspective. So it's, you know, some people are just going to reject that no matter what I say. Talking animals, or you know, the animal sacrifice is necessary, or any of the ridiculous things that are in those books. But you know, people, a lot of religious people, just sort of pick and choose their passages. You know, that the Leviticus says you can't wear clothing of two kinds of cloth. Well, of course, that's stupid. Or the divine right of kings, that we should all have a monarchy. Nobody, no modern Christian or Jew supports that today. They still have democracies, and
I know.
You know, but it is in there very clearly. So, your religion is as religion does, and I think it's a great vehicle for people that helps them behave or find meaning in their life or whatever. but it is still dangerous because the text is there and you will always have a faction that look at it literally. And what you have under Zionism is the worst combination possible, where people are using the religion not to better their lives or whatever, but to give an excuse to their own sense of racism and entitlement over land. God is a real estate agent and a racist, as I always say.
Well, one of the problems is with Judaism, or the Jewishness, as Gilad Osman, he's not the one who coined that term. The term Jewishness is used within the Jewish community, is that Jews, by and large, secular religious, are raised to believe that the Gentiles are against them. So they're raised to have generally anti-Gentile sentiments. But the word anti-Gentilism doesn't exist, right? But this is the way Jews are raised. And so this is one of the aspects of Jewish tribalism. And I don't think any person who's been raised in a very strong Jewish household will deny this. I was not raised in one, but I know many of my friends were. And I found their outlook, even when I was concerned with Palestine, just as their outlook to the world and to the Gentile world was totally warped by the way they had been educated and miseducated as children.
It's just weird to even have a Gentile world instead of the world. I mean, most non-Jewish people grow up, they don't think of the world in terms of Gentile and Jewish. They just think of it as people. Maybe they have some other categories based on language and country and stuff, but they really don't think of themselves as a racial unit. They just...
Exactly.
It's just like be like men versus women or something. It's just stupid. It would never arise.
Nobody's tromping around saying, "I'm a non-Jew." I also find it baffling why people feel the need to take the pain of their ancestors like it's some kind of pissing contest of who was the biggest victim. When it didn't happen to them, it happened to someone else. And they may be related to them by blood or something, but when you're generations removed from the tragedy, it really wasn't happening to you any more than it was your neighbors who don't belong to your little category.
Exactly. It is stupid. And when you give these people political power, when they believe at the same time in their superiority, so you have the so-called Goyim are their enemies, as Yitzhak Shamir, the former terrorist prime minister of Israel, said, the Goyim imbibe anti-Semitism with their mother's milk. And that is something I believe most Jews, particularly those connected to the Jewish establishment, Jewish organizations, Jewish-affiliated organizations, would more or less agree with, which is nonsense. Nonsense.
Well, it's a vicious and circle, because they promote each other. Those in power, which are the psychopaths, are going to promote their own ilk. And so those who reject that kind of philosophy and bear into another one, they don't end up in charge, because it's a system of ethnic nepotism. And so once the racist is in place, they're only going to bring in new racists, obviously, because they're racist. And so you get stuck in this sort of cycle.
This is what has happened. And the situation can't correct itself by itself. It has gotten worse. So you see, in Israel, the ultra-Orthodox, these are the fundamentalists, but in fact, their fundamentalism is based on the Torah, which they study, the first five books of the Old Testament. They study them all the time. And there's a dispute whether or not they should have to serve in the military, but they're largely parasites. They're the ones in the United States, they're not Zionists, but they're willing to take the money that goes along with the what the state provides in Israel, but in the United States, like the state of New York, where they're very powerful. I have my cat here wants to say something, though. where they're very powerful, they have all kinds of scams to get money from the federal government, the state government, and New York City government that are mind-blowing, that do not appear or get reported in the mainstream press. because for the obvious reason, the press is controlled. They do get reported in the New York Jewish Weekly and the Jewish Weekly Forward, but they don't get picked up in the New York Times. And now there's a story, the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, is investigating religious Jews in Israel who never lived in the United States, but are playing around with income tax forms, and they have these crooked income tax preparers that the United States is sending them money for children. They have these huge families. They breed like rabbits. They're supposed to. That's what you're supposed to do, is bring more kids into the world. And they're getting money, like $1,000 per child, from the United States government. And these people have never set foot in the United States. So the IRS is now cracking down on them, according to the Jewish Weekly Forward. But that hasn't appeared in the mainstream press. Obviously, the IRS, if it gets really serious, will be accused of anti-Semitism. But this would be, you need someone like Lewis Carroll or Jonathan Swift to write the story about this, because the way the manipulation goes on and people look the other way because they're afraid to talk about it. So night becomes day, day becomes night. And if the emperor is naked, no one says a word. But this is the way the situation is. That's one of the, going back to that summit, to me, this was a beginning of an exposure that American people have to come to terms with, because their country has been literally occupied in almost every important aspect of it. Now, the president of the United States has to beg, who is no angel as we know, has to beg and plead for the U.S. Senate not to pass new sanctions that would cause Iran to pull out of the talks with the P5+1. And that, you know, also may have a connection to Ukraine, because what the neocons want to do, besides destroy Iran, is they want to break up the U.S., any U.S.-Russian relationship that it is all friendly. And if the Ukrainian situation could cause a breaking up of the negotiations over Iran, that would be a great victory for the neocons and for Israel. And so there is a connection between what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in Iran, and of course what's going on in Israel-Palestine with these phony negotiations. There's a lot going on, but it's all connected. And
that's why you'd see Kagan's wife spearheading the whole thing.
and nobody makes the connection. You know, it's like, I talk about it.
Self-censorship.
Self-censorship. You won't hear any discussion on Democracy Now. You won't hear any discussion of it, or you are not likely to read it in The Nation magazine, or on any of the left websites, because they simply have a certain protective mode, and they think to go too far is to provoke anti-Semitism. And this is one of the reasons non-Jews within the left censor themselves as well, because they have been so indoctrinated into Jewish victimhood, the notion of Jewish victimhood, that they will do the self-censorship because they don't want to get into that situation of provoking anti-Semitism simply by telling the truth.
Separate the two. Israel is not the Jews, and criticizing Israel is not criticizing the Jews. And they've got to be adult and grown up enough to know that. You wouldn't call North Korea the Asians or the Koreans. It's just silly. But it's true. They're scared to death to somebody calling them names. Apparently that's more important than standing up for justice where people are getting killed or put in completely impoverished. That doesn't bother them, but somebody calling them a name, what do we do now? But it'll ruin you. You can never go above a certain mark in journalism if you are willing to call a spade on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Ian, if you're
that's true.
You don't have tenure, you'll lose your job.
We're going to take a break here, and I'll be back with Jeff Blankfort to talk about the censorship of history and continue this discussion about Israel's special relationship. And now for shameless self-promotion. If you shop at Amazon, go click through the Amazon link on my page, which will give me a portion of the sales if you choose to buy anything. And also, I really encourage you to get the ebook, Separation of Business and State. You can find that on ancreport.com's front page.